Hello and welcome to The Good Glow. I am beyond excited and honored to bring this story to you today. I really hope you're going to love this podcast. This season, I've teamed up with ReproMed, Ireland's leading fertility clinics. Having been through the process of IVF myself, I understand how daunting and difficult a fertility journey can be. With clinics in Dundrum, Dublin and Rahoon in Galway, their world-class team offer the expertise, empathy and compassionate care needed to help and support you. Dr. Hans and his team have high levels of success due to their experience and expertise. With 120 years combined fertility experience and passion to help their patients grow their family. You can visit ReproMed.ie, which is packed full of information on IVF, egg donation, fertility preservation, and so much more. Hello and welcome to the Good Glow podcast. I'm literally just in the door from Disneyland. We had the most incredible time. I can't remember the last time I was so present. And my mum and Joe, Nini and Du, brought me and my whole family, my two brothers, Sam and Mick and Kira and Sophie, Jamie and the kids to Disneyland for their 60th birthdays, which took place in COVID. So this trip has been years in the making. We hit the joy button big time and my heart is full. I always think that I'm so in sync with the Good Glow and the themes of the Good Glow. And today's episode is all about love, family, hope. And it's no coincidence that this episode has been released this week when I feel full of that in my heart. And I hope you will too by the end of this episode. So Tara O'Halloran, a new friend of mine, she's a very special lady. I've been following her story for years. I have been manifesting this episode for the Good Glow for months upon months. I dreamed of a day that Tara would sit down with me and tell me her story from start to finish. And I feel so lucky that she agreed to come on the Good Glow. And when you hear this story, I know you're going to be glued to it. So a lot of you probably know about Tara. Tara O'Halloran is from Dublin. She dedicated her life to her family, her husband Richard, and their four kids. But in February 2019, Tara said goodbye to her husband Richard, who was traveling to China to work for about a week because he'd been trying to resolve a dispute between the aircraft leasing company he works for and China's authorities. But when he was there, the situation got worse and he was placed on an exit ban, which meant he couldn't leave the country. As you can imagine, as the weeks and months passed, things went downhill for Richard mentally and physically. Now, while he was there, he was working, he was trying to deal with the demands of the police, being pulled into court, he was threatened and he had to deal with lawyers in Ireland and China. Meanwhile, Tara was at home holding the fort. She was stunned, heartbroken, but had no option but to face the world each and every day, raising their four kids alone. In the beginning, she wasn't able to tell many people where her husband was. And then she moved into a time where there was days and weeks where she didn't know if he was dead or alive. And in those long, unimaginable days, one thing always remained: hope. Hope and Tara's love for her family. Richard kissed his wife goodbye in February 2019. He walked out the door to go to work and she didn't meet him until years later. So different that she didn't even recognize his clothes anymore. And now that he was home and everything had changed, where did they go from there? Today, after turning down a number of offers from TV and radio, Tara tells her story from her heart for the first time on The Good Glow. You will understand once you hear her story how incredible, how strong, kind and powerful this woman is. How through the toughest, most unimaginable times, she found her strength. I hope you enjoy this story of unwavering hope And if you enjoy this episode, stay tuned for something very unexpected at the end, because I can't believe this is where we're going with the Good Glow next week. So much love and gratitude for this incredible family. Tara.
Hi, Georgie.
Welcome to the Good Glow.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
I suppose our story started last summer, but I suppose my story with you started much before that, because I've followed you for so long and I've followed the story, and I didn't want to overstep the mark by contacting you or invade your privacy, but I suppose we have connected over the last while and struck up, I won't overstate it, but a little bit of a friendship, and it's been so nice to get to know you. So thank you for trusting me with your story and for sitting down with me today.
Thank you so much, Georgie, and I'm honoured to be here with you. I've been listening to loads of your podcasts. I'm new to the podcast world. I hadn't really been listening to them before, but now I've listened to almost all of yours, I think. And I just think that you're brilliant and you have a great way with people. And I'm delighted to be here to talk to you today.
Thank you so much. And obviously, I've followed your story, and what your family has been through is just so unique. But I was speaking to you before we came on air, and I was saying that you handled it with such class and such dignity, and you're such a lady. I suppose we need to start with, not to get too into detail of why this happened, but can you just take us back to the start and, you know, from your point of view, where it all went wrong?
Sure. Yeah, I guess, well, to begin back where it was February 2019, my husband Richard travelled to China. There was a dispute within the company that he was working for, and the chairman of his company was arrested. And he was put into jail, and my husband travelled to China to try and see what could be done with his shareholders to sort out, you know, what they wanted to do with the company, under the advice of lawyers, actually. So he flew to China for what he thought was going to be a week-long business trip, and when he went to leave, he was stopped at the airport and questioned by the police, and then told that he wasn't going home, and they were putting an exit ban on his passport. So it was pretty terrifying, to be honest. We just weren't quite sure what was going to happen. And it was a very frightening time, but we kind of thought that, you know, the Department of Foreign Affairs would probably step in and it would be sorted within a couple of weeks, naively, because he was there for 3 years, and we're very lucky that he's home now. He's home a year and a half, but it hasn't been an easy few years, I have to say.
And do you remember that goodbye? You know, was it kind of, you know, sometimes I feel like when Jamie leaves the house or he's going away, I'm like, oh, all right, see you, like, off you go now. Like, did you think about that time?
I was thinking about that the other day, actually. He used to travel a lot because he's in aviation, and ever since I met him, that was kind of the norm, that he travelled an awful lot. So I do remember the day very well, because I remember always thinking back to it. You know, he's always busy when he's leaving, and the kids are always running around, and I'm always like, make sure you say bye to daddy and, you know, like, see you soon. It was only a week's trip, so it wasn't that I was, you know, too sad saying goodbye to him or anything, but I do remember it clearly, and I remember him driving off, but little did I know that that was the last time I was going to see him for 3 years. So, yeah, it was pretty shocking. I remember the time, it was my son Ben was about to make his confirmation, and I remember just thinking, but sure, he can't miss the confirmation, you know. That's such a big day. Like, I was like, Richard, like, Ben's confirmation, you know, you'll have to sort this out. Naively, like, I had no clue what was coming down the line. But yeah, that was first in the series of a lot of big days that he missed. Some good, some bad. My mum dying when he was away was very difficult. She had throat cancer. She was diagnosed just before he left to go to China, and she died about a year after he was there. And I just, yeah, I was very sad because she never got to say goodbye to him, and she adored Richard. I mean, she just loved him.
Yeah, and I've met Richard. I can see how any mother-in-law would love him. He is such an incredible person, and I know that it was just so hard on you. So, you know, when he went and you got that phone call, and of course you're thinking about your immediate future, you know, the confirmation, the day-to-day things, and you of course think it's just going to be sorted out straight away, and you know, there's been some mistake here. And when did you realize that this was a bigger deal than you initially thought?
I think the horror at the beginning, you know, it sank in immediately, but I was sure that it was going to get sorted out. I mean, that was kind of what kept me going for the first while. I was like, this is terrible, but you know, of course they're going to be able to get him home because he hasn't done anything wrong, you know, and this is just a misunderstanding, and so the government will help him and they'll step in, and you know, I'm sure it'll be okay. But as the time passed, I then began to really sink in that, you know, nothing was happening. We were told to keep it very quiet, not to do any media, to make sure that, you know, don't talk to anybody about it, because this was the best way to get him home. So I guess for the first year, it was like walking around with this awful secret, and nobody knew where he was. In fact, I think people in the schools that I was in, they thought we'd split up. And so people just don't ask, you know, they just sort of, they're there and they support you, but they don't really ask because he just wasn't around.
And Tara, like, did people know he was in China? No?
No. I mean, some people didn't. Some people just knew that he wasn't there. Yeah, I used to just say he was away. I used to say different things because I never used to know what to say.
I've met your beautiful, gorgeous children who are just such a credit to you. You must be so proud of them. And not pry into their personal lives, but did they know?
They, at the start, I kind of kept it from them a little bit. I just said that there was a problem with, I sort of told a bit of the truth, but I didn't want to frighten them. So, I mean, my oldest son, I just said that there was a problem with the company and the dad was sorting it out and he was going to have to stay a bit longer than he hoped, but he would try and get home as soon as they, you know, as possible. But they began to realize after a while, that as time passed, that, you know, I couldn't keep saying that to them. So I had to give them, you know, so some of the facts, but without frightening certainly the younger ones. But I was so terrified of the emotional effects on them and the trauma that it might have. And, you know, it's bad enough if your parents say split up or if somebody passes away. But this was kind of worse because it was just the unknown. Mm-hmm. He was just there one minute and gone the next. And for the younger ones, I think, well, also for all of them, actually, that was a really frightening thing for a child to deal with, because your consistency is the most important thing. Mm. As a parent, I feel, you know, just to know that your mom and dad are around, whatever way it works, at least they're there. But for them, he was just gone, you know, and that was really scary for them.
What sort of husband was he before he left?
Oh, he is still. And even when he was there, he was just a great dad. He's amazing. We had four under six when Scarlett, my youngest, was born. So it was fairly crazy few years at the start, but he was always very hands-on. You know, there was always a baby or a toddler in the mix, and so it was just all hands on deck with the two of us. And I suppose we were just coming to the stage where, you know, it wasn't as frenetic and it was wonderful, and the kids were kind of a bit older, so there wasn't that panic of, you know, little ones running around or getting hurt or whatever. But yeah, it just, he missed an awful lot, because my youngest was five, Scarlett. Ben, my oldest, was 12. So he's 16 now, you know, Richard's home a year, but he missed a very big chunk in their lives. Like, he missed an awful lot, which for him was heartbreaking. We tried to keep him in the loop as much as we could, and we did FaceTime as much as we could, but it's not the same, obviously, you know. I just, like, Christmas Day would break your heart. He'd be on FaceTime for the whole day and we'd have him in the middle of the table. And
oh, it's really?
Just, yeah, it was awful. I mean, awful for him. Just wrong for the kids to have to see their dad like that. But it's the only way we could have him there, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
And how did you think he was doing mentally? Like, when I think about, say, my relationship with Jamie, I always feel like he's the strong one. Like he, if there's a crisis, he's the one that's kind of like steering the ship. What's the dynamic like in your relationship?
I think before he left, we were, this for want of a better expression, very traditional. Sort of, he went to work. I was at home with the kids. It was pretty busy. So that was great. I love my kids. I always wanted to be a mom at home and, you know, just I love the craziness, love all of it. But I suppose I would rely on him to do a lot of stuff, you know, like the financial side of running a family and the house and everything. And when he left, I suppose I realized there was so much that I didn't know how to do for myself. And I just had to step up and learn how to do all that stuff for myself. And it was kind of empowering, I suppose. Not good necessarily, but like just I did find a strength in myself that I realized there was all this stuff that I could do and I just hadn't been doing. And yeah, that was the one good thing that came out of it. I became much stronger.
And were you trying to support him on the phone a lot? Like, were you the person that he turned to for that support?
I definitely was. I mean, he was very unwell. I think a lot of people know this just from some of the articles and things that since he came home, but he's very open about the fact that he's an alcoholic and, you know, it all kind of happened over there. It got very bad and he was very unwell. He was hospitalized twice. His heart stopped. He was on the verge of death. Like, he was very, very unwell. So that was quite tough trying to talk him through those times. There were times he didn't want to talk to me. There was times when he wouldn't talk to me for a month or more. It would just depend. But it was very worrying because if I didn't talk to him, I couldn't gauge if he was alive or dead, if he was okay. So I helped as much as I could, but sometimes it was really tough.
Why do you think he wouldn't talk to you? Was he?
I think at that point when he wouldn't talk to me, he just told me that he'd just given up. Like he just couldn't cope with it. He didn't want to hear the kids talking, didn't want to hear me talking because he was just so unwell. And he just said he was wanted to die pretty much. There was nothing for him to live for. So yeah, that was heartbreaking. And I remember being so worried about him and ringing Simon Coveney and saying, can you please just check that he's still alive? Like, we haven't heard from him. I have no way to reach him. I just need somebody to go to his apartment and make sure that he's still here. So he did, and we got confirmation that he was still alive, but it was awful. Like, it was really, really so tough just wondering if he was alive or dead, or, you know, he was just so unwell and so unhappy. And I just knew at that stage I had to get him home. That was the driving force for me, is that I just knew at that stage that if I didn't get him home, that he might not make it.
It must have been just such an awful time. And you wear this beautiful chain around your neck saying hope. Did you always have hope, or did the hope fade?
I think that I still wear that necklace. My group of my girlfriends, my oldest friends, gave me that necklace when my mum died, actually. And it was just, it didn't seem like there was a whole lot of hope. But it's such an important word. And it actually, my whole family, my whole story has been about that. And I kind of find it a comfort now, because I think hope is the one thing that keeps you going when you're really at that stage, when you're at the rock bottom stage and you think that, you know, you're not going to make it, or, you know, it's not going to happen. Hope is the only thing that you have. And yeah, we were so lucky. Like, we are so lucky to have him home. It's kind of had a happy ending, but it was hope that got me through that time, definitely.
Yeah, I think sometimes, like, hope is the only way you can get up in the morning, face the world. And those days when you weren't hearing from him, how did you get through the day?
Do you know, it's a lot of it is almost like a blur. I do remember that I just knew that I had to get up, I had to put on the makeup, I had to get the breakfast for the kids, get out the door, get them to school. And then sometimes it was just get to the hospital to see my mum. But I just had to keep putting one foot in front of another, even if I didn't feel like it, because when you've four kids, you just, I had to keep letting them know that everything was going to be okay, because they were definitely looking at me to say, is it okay? Like, this is really bad. Are we going to be okay? And that's all I could do, was just reassure them that, yeah, everything's going to be okay. We're going to be fine. Even if we're on our own, we're going to be fine. I'm going to mind you, you know. And no matter how I was feeling, I had to just get them through it. So that also got me through it, I think.
Mm. When you told your story and people actually understood, did you find it easier from that point? Because I think sometimes when we like hold things in and we have to keep a secret, it's just so stressful.
Yeah, no, I'm very lucky in some sense that my kids at the time were in three different schools in the same area. And I had so many like people around me. I had a big community of moms and parents and stuff, but friends, that I would meet so many people in the mornings, say, and in the afternoons, just people all the time, because the connections between the three schools were was huge. And when people did start to know, I suppose it was really when I started doing interviews and things like that, that a lot of people started to know. But when my close group of friends even started to know, I mean, they were all amazing. But it was a little bit of a relief, because I could at least say what was happening, that I wasn't holding the secret in. But I suppose I'm quite a proud person, and I always was trying to let people think that I was okay all the time. You know, they'd say, God, like, it must be awful. Are you okay? And I'd be like, yeah, we're good. It's awful, but we're fine. And I did that for a long time, I think, because that was my only way of coping. You know, you just put on a smile and everything's going to be okay. But it wasn't okay all the time. Like, you know, there was lots of times I'd come home, I'd put the kids to bed, and I'd just cry, you know, on my own, silently, so the kids wouldn't hear me. But I was like, how am I going to sort this out? Like, how am I going to get my family back together? Like, what am I going to do? I just was at such a loss as to know. It was so huge, this thing. I can't fight a government. Like, I can't, I don't have the power to reach these people. I don't know what they want from him. He doesn't know what they want from them. Nobody really seems to be pushing. Like, what am I going to do? You know, I was at a loss. But it's amazing, the power of people and friends and the support that, you know, everybody was trying to help. People were emailing me, people's sisters, people's uncles, people's aunties, saying, I might know somebody here. Maybe we could talk to so-and-so. Have you tried this? You know, it was just, it was unbelievable, the outpouring of support that we got. And it really, it was such a comfort to me, because I felt so on my own. But as time went on, I realized that there were so many people rooting for us and for him. Mm. That was amazing. To know that people cared so much.
Yeah, and it does make such a difference. Did you ever think that he might be there forever?
We did. And I mean, yeah, Richard at a certain point started to say, Tara, like, you might need to get on with your life. Like, I don't know. You know, he was very, very low at that point. And I was like, no, we're not giving up. Like, we're not going to give up. And this is not the end of it. This is not you there forever. Like, we're going to find a way. Like, there must be a way. So that's when I started pushing with, you know, against all advice. I started doing radio interviews, speaking to the media, and it was powerful, because that did start to have an effect. That was the first time the thing started to move, when that started.
And that's that, like, trust in your gut, that, you know, when you know what's right for your family, to just connect with that. And that's what you did.
Yeah. No, it really was. And it went against everything. People who know me would say that it was so not what you would expect me to do, because it wasn't in my nature, exactly. And I was terrified at the start. God, I was so frightened. The first radio interview I did, I remember I was shaking. I thought I was going to be sick. I was like, oh, God. But I knew I had to do it for a reason. Like, it was like a job. It was just one purpose, was to get him home. So that was the driving force. And yeah, I did it. It became easier after a while.
What did you miss most about him?
I guess I missed so many things about him. I missed, obviously, the companionship, you know, having someone to talk to in the evenings when the kids had gone to bed. Mm. it was little things. Like, I remember I used to see people walking down the road holding hands, and oh God, like those kind of things would make me get upset, because I would think, God, like I might never have that again, you know? I just missed everything about him. It was like just having him here, having dinner, the little things, like just the normal stuff, you know? I don't know. Yeah, it's everything.
It's the five-star moments that I speak about, you know? It's not the holiday. It's not the, you know, the big stuff. It's the small stuff. It's the flicking on the cat. It's like probably the annoying things that they do.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. We're back to that now.
Yeah. So tell us about then the, when things started to change, or did it go from one way to the other really quickly, or were you starting to get good news?
I think it's funny. We were talking before we came on here about Twitter, and my family thought this was so funny when I went on Twitter, because I was on no social media, didn't know how to do Instagram. I wasn't even on Facebook, like literally nothing. And I somehow got myself onto Twitter, and I said, right, you know, this is going to be how I'm going to reach people. I'm going to reach the politicians that I need to talk to. I'm going to find people that, you know, have influence that can help me, because I knew I didn't have the power to do that. So as scary a world as Twitter is, it was amazing for me, because I did connect with some people who were so supportive, and there was just a handful of people that would tweet for Richard all the time. You know, they would just be campaigning for him, and they'd be on it, you know, just really hitting the right politicians, hitting the government.
And did you know these people?
I didn't then, but then I started to get to know some of them. And then before I knew it, they were sitting in my kitchen having coffee, and
wow.
We were getting things done. And it was just, yeah, it was amazing, the support. I think politicians get really bad press, some of them, but there was certain ones that really helped me, actually. And there were even, they had arranged for me to speak in front of an Oireachtas committee, which was huge. You know, they'd invited myself and Ben, and I don't think they'd ever invited a child to come on before. And that was due to happen about a week before he came home. So that was very telling that, you know, we didn't get to do it, but it had reached that level where, you know, there was going to be lots of questions asked, and why wasn't more happening to get him home?
So Richard had said that he rang you from the airport and was like, I think I'm going to get out. And he had been to the airport a number of times before. Is that right?
Yeah. The previous time he tried to come home, it was Ben's birthday, and he was trying to surprise him. And he'd been told by one of the judges at the time that, you know, the exit ban had been lifted. So technically he was free to go if the exit ban had been lifted. So he decided to try to come home. So he went to the airport. He didn't actually tell me that he was trying to come home, because he didn't want me to be disappointed. But he went to the airport and he tried to check in, and he was escorted out of the airport by about 10 police officers. And he was heartbroken, because, you know, he just knew that was pretty much it. You know, that was the one time he thought he might be able to, and it was just clear that he wasn't going to be allowed to come home. So
that's so disappointing for him.
Broke him. Yeah, he was just, well, we were all gutted, but the chance of him just being almost on the plane was just so awful when he was turned away. It was a hard phone call.
But the phone call did come that looked promising.
Yes. I mean, Richard, he's brilliant. He found his strength over there, and he started to get well, and he got sober, and he used that energy and he channeled it into, you know, just doing everything he could to get himself home. So he negotiated with the judge, and, you know, he agreed to continue to honour the contract that he had. As he'd said all along, he was willing to do. And he basically made a deal with the judge, and they agreed to lift the exit ban, which is unheard of. I mean, we just couldn't believe it. It was a miracle, really, that happened. And until he got onto the plane, I think it was just terrifying, because we knew that he might not same thing could happen again. It could be stopped and just taken off the plane.
How was he communicating with you that day?
That day he was on the phone. Okay. And he checked in, and I remember I was so frightened. I just was like, my heart was in my mouth, and I could hear, you know, the people talking to him, going, trying to check him through. And I heard there was some debate that they stopped them, something along the lines of, oh, hang on a second. And I was going, oh God, this is it. Like, he's going to be taken off, you know, he's going to be taken out of the airport again. He's not going to get on the plane. So he said to me, I have to ring you back, Tara. And I said, oh God. So he hung up the phone, and the longest 10 minutes of my life, he rang me back and he said, I just got through. He said, I've just got through. He said, I'm out. Like, I'm nearly on the plane. I was like, oh my God.
Oh my God. And then
he sent me a photo of him with the pilot of the plane, of him in the seat on the plane. And it was just, yeah, even while he was on the plane, we were still terrified, you know. Mm-hmm. We were watching the plane fly over. There's so many people were texting me, and, you know, well, it's only a small group of people knew, but we were watching the flight, just praying that, you know, he had to stop in Seoul. And I remember just going, oh my God, just please let him get home.
I hope you're enjoying this episode of the Good Glow podcast. Before we get back to it, I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank ReproMed for supporting the Good Glow again this season. A fertility journey is so personal, and ReproMed pride themselves in taking compassionate interest in your care. Having spent time with the team, I know they will provide you with everything you need to know about treatment options in a safe, supportive, and honest environment. ReproMed has invested significantly in the past 3 years in their state-of-the-art laboratory to give their patients the best chance of success, and are trusted and recommended by maternity hospitals and GPs throughout Ireland. Visit ReproMed.ie for more. How long was that journey then that you tracked?
God, well, it was, I can't even remember exactly how many hours, but I remember my son Ben had a rugby match at the same time. So I was running in and out, and it was just the most surreal feeling, because we knew that he'd be home the next day. It was so quick. Like, I couldn't believe, you know, suddenly that he was coming home. I was trying to get my head around it, going, oh my God. Like, in the morning, we're going to be collecting him from the airport.
God, I can't, I can't even imagine what that must have felt like for you.
Yeah, it was, oh, it was so amazing, so exciting, but so scary as well.
So
I was
scary.
Suddenly going, oh my God, my husband's coming home after 3 years. I was a bit nervous, actually. I was a bit scared, because I just didn't know what to expect.
Because it wasn't over for you, because you knew that he was coming home different.
Yeah, totally. I mean, totally different. And I was very different as well, apart from anything else. So I was like, how is this going to work even? I had spent so long thinking about actually physically getting him home that, you know, he was coming home. I was just going, oh my God.
Practicalities of life.
Yeah, it was surreal. And I didn't tell anybody. I told Ben, my son, because he's the oldest, I told him the night before, look, it looks like Dad might be coming home tomorrow. But I hadn't told the girls.
What did Ben say?
This was the 2 nights before he came home. Ben was thrilled, but he knew from previous experience, I suppose, he didn't get his hopes up hugely, because he still had this thought in his head that it might not happen. But then when it actually came to it, we were kind of rushed, because apparently there was a leak to the press, and they were going to leak that he was coming home before I'd even told the kids. And I had to rush to collect them from school and tell them, because it was going to be on the 1 o'clock news, and this was at like 12:30. So I had to run and collect them, and the school was amazing. Actually, they gave us a little private room to go into, and I had to just, they were terrified actually, because they thought something bad had happened when they were called out of class. And I told them, and it was amazing. I mean, there were tears, they were laughing, they were screaming, they were delighted. But it was very rushed, and not the way I wanted to be able to tell them or prepare them, because it's a lot for kids to digest that, you know, and to get their heads around it. But anyway, we were just so glad that he was coming home. So
what happens at the airport?
So we went to the airport and they were all a bit nervous, actually. We were all, well, I certainly was a bit nervous. And they were very good to us in the airport, actually. They gave us a lovely room and they set up little croissants for the kids, and the kids were just so excited. And when he walked through the door, I actually couldn't believe it, because there he was, kind of looked the same, but also very different. He'd lost about 2 stone. You know, he looked a bit older. I'd say I looked a lot older. I'd say that's what he was thinking, but the kids didn't really know what to do. You know, they were kind of afraid, but anyway, we all had the biggest hug and it was fantastic. Like, it was just such a lovely moment, and we didn't actually go anywhere straight away. We just sat for about an hour and had the croissants, and just, it was surreal. Like, it was so surreal to see him sitting there, and the kids were just in awe that he was actually there. So it was amazing. And then we went into a van and there was all newspaper photographers and everything outside, and you know, the kids just, it was such a strange experience for them. Like, they just, the most important thing was that their dad was home, but they, you know, the interest was, for them, they couldn't quite believe it. Mm. You know, because it was just their dad, it wasn't,
yeah. And for Richard as well, to have been so isolated for so long and then to come home to a lot of people, yeah. You know, that's, yeah. Were you really aware of kind of minding him?
I was, because obviously we have 4 kids and it's a very busy house. It's very noisy. It's like there's a lot goes on in a day. And I think for Richard, had been living solitary for 3 years with just himself in his apartment. I think it was sensory overload. You know, it was just a lot for him to take in. And when the kids warmed up to being around him again, like, they just couldn't let go of him. And mm. they were, you know, they just wanted to be with him all the time. And he was brilliant. He coped with it so well. But I mean, the first moment when he came home and him looking around his own house, but a bit different, you know, 3 years later, I remember him asking me, could he have a cup of tea? And that nearly broke my heart, like, you know, because he just didn't feel like it was his house again yet. He'd kind of forgotten where the bowls were in the kitchen, or it just, everything was different. You know, he'd packed his bag for China to go for like 10 days. So he'd no clothes. So he had to buy a whole new wardrobe of clothes over there for the 3 years. So the first thing he did when he came home was he threw out all his old clothes because they didn't fit him anymore.
Mm.
So like, I didn't even recognize his clothes, you know, a small thing that, like, it was a bit like we were strangers for a while. Yeah, it was really difficult at the beginning.
Obviously, he was different when he came back, but was it different?
I think it was so different. And he says the same thing, is that I was quite different, probably.
Yeah.
I was probably a lot more assertive. Mm. He might have another word for that. But no, I just was used to being in charge of everything. And yeah. I'm probably a bit of a control freak anyway, but I hope I wasn't with him, but like, I was running things in a certain way, and it was probably difficult for him to slot back into that. I mean, the kids were still looking at me if they wanted to do something or go somewhere, or, you know, they'd ask me for permission. And so it's lots of little things like that were difficult for him to get back to where he was before. He says himself that he felt a bit like the fifth child, you know. He just sat back and let me take the lead because he didn't want to, I don't know, just, he just didn't want to do anything wrong.
Yeah. And I think as a woman, like, reading your story and reading the journey that you've been on, like, that's the part of it that I always wondered about, because I think for someone to be away for so long and then to integrate back into the home is so, so difficult. And like, you guys have done so well. Like, when I sat with you for breakfast last week, you're just so complimentary of each other, and it's a beautiful home. There's such lovely energy here, and I'm so happy that he's home and everything's worked out. What would you say the biggest change in him was?
I think there's so many changes now. When he came home, I am not going to pretend it was all, you know, happiness and roses like the whole way, because when he came home, it was very difficult. And he started going to counselling. I said, you're going to have to go to counselling because otherwise you're not going to be able to integrate back into the family. And I also did a lot of counselling with the kids when he was away. We did a group counselling every week, which was hugely helpful, actually. Mm. Because, yeah, you need those support tools, I think, in that situation. We just didn't, it was such a strange situation. I remember my GP saying to me, you know, when somebody's like kidnapped or something, there's huge support when they come back. Like, it's not like he was kidnapped, but he was gone for 3 years. And he said, you cannot do this without having some therapy and some support. So I think that was absolutely crucial for us as a family. And he's, as a result of the counselling, he's so much more calm. He's much more balanced. He's much happier, definitely. And we all are, actually. I think it's a year and a half now. He's back. I was saying that the other day, that he's back half the time he was gone. Mm. But it's taken us that long, you know, just to get to a stage where we're all happy as a family again, that we know our kind of our place in the family and our roles. And, you know, it's lovely now. It's a relief because I feel like we're back to, you know, the way we were before, but better. Actually. Yeah, much better.
I had a feeling you were going to say that because I think for people who've been through things and you're so kind of, I just want things to go back to normal. I just want things to go back to normal. And then you work your way through it. And then you realize, actually, I don't want to go back to normal.
No.
Because everything you've learned will, you know, stand to you. And I think it was interesting there what you said about therapy and it balances you. And that's such an amazing way to describe it. It balances you. That's what it does.
Yeah. And I think the anger can drive you to achieve things as well, if you channel it in the right way.
But yeah.
It can either eat you up or you can use it to do something good, I think.
So how would you say your life is very different now than it
before? I think it is very different, actually. We both sort of decided when he came home to sort of rewrite the rule book as such. You know, we don't have to do everything the way we used to do it. Because it's when you've got the four kids, it's very much all about ticking boxes and make the breakfast, make the lunch, put them to bed, brush your teeth, do this, do that. And I think now we have a little bit more freedom with that. And it's more about having a lot of fun with the kids, and not all the time, but but just, you know, making more happy times than ticking boxes, I think, for us. And I suppose we're making up for lost time. So yeah, it's everybody needs to do what makes them happy. And that includes me. I think when he was away, I was very focused on the kids and didn't really give time for myself. And now that he's home, it's a lovely relief for me because I can go out for a long walk by myself, or I can leave the kids and not be worried or panicked. Or he can go off and meet a friend for lunch or whatever it is. And yeah, it's we've found a good balance, I think.
You found independence, but knowing that you are happier together, but also you're able to connect with that independence.
Yeah.
I was asked, I was on a podcast the other day and someone said, what would be the gift you, if you could give all mothers, you'd give them? And my answer was time.
Yeah.
And obviously no one would wish that time on you in terms of like what circumstances the time was given to you in, but that time did allow you to get to know who you were.
Absolutely. I mean, and also to connect with a lot of my female friends that, I mean, some new and some old friends, but when you're, you know, when you're married with four children, you tend to just get in that rut of only being with your family. And I was so lucky that I had all these women in my life and they literally held me up through the whole thing. They were so supportive. I really felt so lucky to have them. I mean, they dropped dinners on my door. I had a friend across the road who used to drop a candle on my doorstep every week. There was things just arrived at the door. Often people didn't even ring the bell. They just would leave stuff for me. And after a while, I began to photograph it, actually. So I have a little album in my phone of all the kind things that people did when Richard was away, just because I wanted to be able to show him when he came home.
if you had a crystal ball back at the start of the journey, and like obviously there's so many times that you were on your knees, like do you have this deep gratitude for every second that your life is okay now?
I do. I think when my mum died, when he was away, that was the darkest time, I'd say. And I don't think I really processed the grief at the time because I just couldn't. So I feel the last year has been hugely transformative for me because I've got a lot of time to think about her and to process all that stuff that I just sort of put on hold because I just couldn't do it at the time. And I'm trying to leave behind the anger that I had at the time because I was angry that he wasn't there, that he wasn't allowed to come home, that he was denied that chance to say goodbye to my mum. But I know that she had a big part in getting him home. We both feel that. Actually, Richard says, without a doubt, my mum was the one who orchestrated him getting home from China.
At what point of the journey did your mum pass?
It was about a year after he left.
Okay.
She was diagnosed just before he went to China, and she had throat cancer. She was the most amazing lady. Margie was her name.
Margie.
Yeah. And she was just the most wonderful mum, as everybody's mums are wonderful, but she was particularly wonderful. She was just this phenomenal person. Sorry. Still get upset. But we were so lucky to have her.
Yeah. And you still have her. You still have her.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely think she's still here. Like I see signs of her everywhere. I don't know if that's just me wanting to see the signs, but I definitely feel like she's still with us here.
What's your sign for your mum?
There's lots of different signs. When she first died, I was sitting in the car with my sister and we were both really upset. We were both crying. And the biggest rainbow popped up in the sky, like literally popped up, I mean, out of nowhere. And anyway, the two of us started bawling, crying even more. And ever since that, we just saw rainbows everywhere for a long time after she died. And we'd all send each other photos of the rainbows whenever they popped up. But I see signs in so many things. We often see butterflies that we think are her. I have a little robin in my garden and it's funny. I just feel like it's definitely her, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know if that stuff is true, but I certainly believe it is.
I think you just walk through the doors of this house and there's just love. You're just surrounded by love.
Oh, thanks, Georgie.
I am so honoured to sit with you in your house and for you to have opened your doors to me and for you now to be part of the Good Glow community, because I know you speak about how important it is, your relationship with women, and I really hope... Are you on Instagram?
I'm not very good at it. I have a very small little Instagram, but I'm not great at it, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to put your Instagram in the show notes and I hope that women will reach out to you. I hope the women that listen to this podcast will send you a message because you put out so much love into the world and I hope that you will feel that now once our episode is out from everyone who listens to this podcast. So welcome to the crew.
Thanks, Georgie. I'm so honoured. My God, thank you so much. And it means so much to me. I really appreciate you taking the time and just for taking the interest and actually for all your support through the whole thing, because I know you were helping on Twitter and you were, you know, emailing me, and I really am so grateful to that, to you and to lots of other women, but it's so nice to be here chatting to you today.
Yeah, and I even said, like, you know, if you didn't feel comfortable doing the podcast, like I was so happy for us to just connect and be friends. We're practically neighbours.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
Hopefully we can get out for one of those walks together instead of listening to the Good Glow. Maybe we can have a chat instead in real life.
I would love it, Georgie. Thank you so much. Honestly, thanks a million.
Thank you so much, Tara, for sharing your story with us today on The Good Glow. Now, I don't know if you may have figured it out by now what's coming up next week on The Good Glow.
So I was allowed to live in China. I wasn't allowed to go far from where I was. So I was living in a hotel and I suppose being away for 3 years, life just chips away at you. And the experience just erodes the soul and your core. I just didn't feel you could trust anyone, literally. And even speaking to people back home here, there was always the fear that, or the realization that you're being listened to. Everything was being monitored.
Yes, next week we will hear from Richard. Thank you so much for tuning in today. If you enjoyed this episode, please make sure to put it in your WhatsApp group, send it to your friends, and follow the Good Glow podcast wherever you're listening, because that's the best way that you can support me. Thank you so much. We'll be in the National Concert Hall on December 3rd. Our first ever Christmas show. We're going to have high vibe Christmas music. We're going to have inspiring guests. We're going to set you up for Christmas in the best possible way. So have your Christmas party with a Good Glow, or your girls' lunch or dinner afterwards or before. We are going to have so much fun. Visit National Concert Hall for tickets, and I'll leave a link down below in the episode show notes if you'd like to join us on Sunday, December 3rd at 5 p.m. in the National Concert Hall. We are nearly sold out, so tickets are limited. Thanks so much for tuning in. And as I said, Richard will be joining us next week. There is so much more of this story to tell from Richard's point of view. Today was all about Tara and the story from her point of view. And I know so many of you will want to know what it was like for Richard on a day-to-day basis over in China. So I had the most beautiful conversation with Richard, and that's coming your way next week. Thanks a million. Talk to you then.